Thank you all for coming out this evening. And I'm reminded that it's now 10 years since we've started doing these Bright Nights community forums. And they have been just a delight to participate in. And I want to acknowledge Trish Meyer at the Depression Center, who has been really one of the driving forces in organizing these evenings and helping organize the speakers and the presenters in it. So I just want to thank her publicly, even though she's not here this evening. It is my pleasure to talk about Priori. And I'm going to be talking about how the idea really came to us and how we started doing it and where we are with it. And hopefully we'll have a discussion as to where technology is going to go and take us in healthcare. And the point that I want to make is that it's not whether technology is going to be used in monitoring and helping take care of us, but how. And it's very important for us to guide that discussion. The name Priori stands for Predicting Individual Outcomes for Rapid Interventions. And the individuals that have been working on this with me, John Gideon, who's here tonight, is going to be on the panel. Emily Provost, who would have been here this evening, except she's due any day now for her firstborn child, so we're giving her the day off. Satinder Singh, who is a senior computer scientist at the University of Michigan College of Engineering, has been instrumental in this. Valerie Foster, who is works on the front line interacting with the individuals, as well as Jennifer Montgomery, who's also on the front line interacting with the folks. So first, I want to define what mobile health is. And so mobile health is the practice of medicine and public health that's supported by mobile devices, essentially. And it's a subsegment of electronic health, e-health, which just means that it's the use of communication technology, computers, mobile phones, satellites, and all that to help us as a just as an instrument, as a tool to help us with our health. But we all really know where this originated. And those of you that watched television in the 60s remember the tricorder on Star Trek. And it was one of the most amazing things that I recall watching those episodes where Bones would bring up his tricorder and he'd flash it in front of somebody and say, he's low on hemoglobin. Absolutely brilliant. And you see them here in action with their tricorder device. Healthcare today is in a slight a bit of a crisis. And we are really a reactive healthcare system. We react to problems. When you have a tummy ache or you have a sore throat, you go to the doctor. When something happens, you go to the doctor. This has a considerable amount of cost with it, and the cost, from my perspective, just seems to be going up and up, and there's really no end in sight. In psychiatry, in particular, there's an increased public awareness of what psychiatry can do and what medicine can do, and we're learning that there are many options out there. There are many things that we can help people with. So, in fact, our services are being sought. Our resources, and I was trying to figure out the best word to identify or to talk about the resources, but our resources are highly regulated in the sense of, you know, the bureaucracy that regulates, you know, what the standards of care are, what you can have or have not in a hospital. So we need our system to turn into something that's proactive. And so we really need to figure out how we can solve problems in advance. Mobile technology has the potential to be scalable. So you can have one technology that can be scalable to a large number of individuals. We can then use this technology to leverage the current resources. So even though we are limited in many ways to the resources, if we're able to leverage those at using mobile health. I want to recommend this book to you. I know that Jenny will have it here in the library. The patient will see you now. Slightly provocative, but very appropriate in the sense that, you know, we need to have a healthcare system that is responsive to the needs of the patient. And so when I am ill, I want to see my doctor. You know, when I need something, I would prefer to be able to have relatively quick access of it, to it. And so Eric Topol, who in fact was here at the University of Michigan in the 1980s, has written extensively on mobile technology, is pointing out that with these mobile devices, we're going to be able to be there. And I think it's going to be sooner than you think. So the illness that I study is bipolar disorder. And bipolar disorder, as many of you know, is an unstable, periodic illness. It's difficult to predict when an individual is headed for an episode, difficult to predict when they become when they're becoming manic or when they're becoming depressed. And the word of the day is that we need a biomarker. We need something to tell us, you know, when things are heading for a problem. Now, the thing that this cartoon that I'm showing here, I apologize, but I find it from time to time slightly pejorative, but it actually emphasizes a point. It emphasizes that the outward expression of an individual with bipolar disorder when they are in the throes of an episode is really rather, or in many ways, there are many features that are apparent, both in their behavior, but notably in their speech. And so they're often dressed in a very loud, particular manner. But most importantly, their speech is loud, rapid, and it's got a push to it. It just is, some people have used the word, you know, just overly loud and obnoxious. In the depressive phase, the individual is quieter. There's less energy. They just don't have the will to take care of themselves in the way that they should. Clothes are tattered. Everything is down. Energy level is down. And as many of you know, the illness is in a waveform. So individuals merge into mania, go into their baseline state, and then merge or go down into depression. Many of you will know of the Prechter bipolar study, which is a longitudinal study of bipolar disorder, and we have approximately 1,080 individuals that are now participants in the study. The study's been going on now for about 9 years, and we've been very privileged to have the participation of many people. And the essence of the study is that we have a very in-depth, detailed initial assessment, all kinds of interviews, but every year we follow up and get some information on the individual, so we have a sense of how well someone is doing. And so what we have learned is of no real news to us, but we were able to document this in our observations, is that the illness goes up and down. People are going up and down all the time. So you can see their individuals. So this, what you're looking at here, is the patient health questionnaire, which is a self-report symptom severity score. The maximum score is about 27, and the minimum score is essentially zero. So what you can see on this is that there are a number of individuals that have a very high amplitude of their severity scores. And they not only have a high amplitude, each of the colors, it represents one individual, but they also have a particular period to their variation, so that there are individuals that are going high in amplitude in their symptom severity scores, and they're coming down, and then in a brief, relatively brief period of time, each of these wee ticks here down at the bottom represent a month, and these longer ticks represent a year. So this is over a long period of time. So we're getting a sense of how people are varying over time. And it's very humbling to appreciate that there's a considerable variability in how people feel. And these are individuals that are in our study. They're individuals that are getting care from a psychiatrist, in town or somewhere not in the too far of a vicinity, very close by here. About 20 to 30% of the individuals are in care at the University of Michigan health system. So, we asked the question 4 or 5 years ago, can we use speech to monitor mood? Why? Because one of the things that we train our residents and our medical students to observe when they're evaluating someone with bipolar disorder is to listen to how they speak, the features of, you know, what they sound like, how they're using words, and just in general, how they're speaking and how they're using these words. And so the hypothesis is is that speech acoustics can be used as a proxy measure, stand-in measure, if you will, for the emotional states. And so why speech? Well, it's modulated, you know, by the speaker. We all use it on a daily basis when you wake up in the morning and you go into work and you greet your colleagues or whatever you do starting the day. You get a sense of how people are doing by the how they sound, right? Regardless of what you do, you come down in the morning and have breakfast with your family. You know how someone's doing just by the way they start engaging and talking with us. So we're using speech on a regular basis. We all do it. And so we propose that we can collect speech in a rather in a cheap and remote manner. And so as a psychiatrist, I have learned from families, I've learned from friends, from the people that interact with individuals with bipolar disorder, that they say, Dr. McGinnis, I could hear it in their speech. I knew there was something going on. So we knew that this was happening. So my background, bipolar is kind of a neurological energy state is my point. I use this slide just to demonstrate a really key point. In my background, I grew up on a farm. I'm a farmer, grew up as a farmer. And our livelihood was dependent on machines. And so this is a combine that harvests the grain in the autumn. And the point that my father made to me is that you need to know the sound of a well-running machine. You need to know the sound of a happy animal versus a sick animal because our livelihood depends on it. And I don't want a situation coming up here, son, when a squeaky noise comes up in that combine, it means that there's a problem, and it will go away. It will go away. But do not be convinced, do not even try to convince yourself that because the sound goes away, it means everything's fine. It just means that there's a bearing somewhere that's about to go, and that squeaky noise is that the bearing is rubbing against something, and when the noise goes away, it means that the bearing's gone and you got axle to, things, and so the whole shebang is going to go on us, and then we're going to really be in trouble. So let me know as soon as something's going on. So it's a preventative it's a preventative method. It's a method of identifying something in advance to let us know that there's a problem. So going back to priori, it's really from prediction to prevention. And so this slide is the slide I want you to remember. Think of the baseline state. And so a patient or anyone who's going sailing up into a mania. So you have a slope on this change point here. So if we could have an early warning system, EWS for early warning system, it's kind of an idiot light, in the car system, if to use an automotive analogy, it's sort of the idiot light on there. So if an early warning system can detect a change in the acoustic patterns of an individual in sufficient time to say there's a problem, all it's doing is that the check engine light, if you will, is coming on in your car. We don't know exactly what the problem is, but we know there's a problem. So if this individual here going up in this could then seek help or that they say, here's an indicator that you should go and talk to your doctor, potentially we can avert the severity of the episode, and so you could then divert the symptoms and diminish the symptom severity. So this is not the prior itself doing anything, but it's just alerting to the fact that the check engine light has come on. Many a patient that I have will say to me, when I get into that hypomanic state, a few steps into here, I love it. And I've lost the will to really change anything. I want to stay there. And if I could just stay in that one state, that would be great. But they said, in the reality, I know that I go into this high energy manic state, and then all hell breaks loose, and it's just a major problem. So priori, we then went to the computer science and engineering department at the University of Michigan College of Engineering and asked them, can you help us devise a system that will work as an early warning system for speech? And so John and his colleagues and others, they helped us devise an application, an app, that resides sitting on this phone, for example, resides on the phone. And what happens is that the individual talks on the phone like you would just talk on any phone. It captures the speech on the phone, and this key here is to indicate that it's encrypted. And we spent about a year and something talking with security people about how about the best way to encrypt it, because we're not interested in the content. We don't really we care what you say, really, but we don't really care what you say. It's just how it is said that is the matter for us. And then there's a thing here called feature extraction, and I have learned such a tremendous amount of the engineering of acoustics that I was not aware of. It's a fascinating topic, and amazing. So we have the mood state evaluation. So we want to know what the person, whether they're revved up or depressed at any given time. And so these are combined together, and then we can make a decision whether these features, whether there are features that identify a manic state or identify a depressed state. And so the the data indicate that about 70 to 80% of the time, the computerized system can identify the state, which is actually, we think it's actually quite good. So mHealth, what is the capacity then? So we should be able to gather more data more frequently. We can improve our efficiency. Remember the slide I was talking about, leveraging our resources, so we want to get more data. We want to monitor chronic disease. We want to just use it, if you will, as the check engine light for chronic disease. And this then defines what we call secondary and tertiary prevention. And so what that means is that you have an individual with a disorder such as bipolar disorder, and that you can identify when they're headed for an episode and then implement an intervention strategy. So we're getting at the right patient at the right time with the right at the right care. And so what we're about now is that we are embarking on, so we've been very fortunate to have the support of the University of Michigan. And so we've got some additional funding right now to work with a company that will help us put this in the cloud, if you will. And so what we want to be able to do is get this system working such that all the individual has to do is to say, go to Google Play or, you know, such is the case, wherever you get your Play Store, download it, and go through the hoops to engage in priority. So we have right now about 37, 38 individuals that are using it and establishing that it works. We want to get thousands or tens of thousands of individuals using it to test it, to test the efficacy of it. So we want to improve the capacity with the online version. We want to improve the efficacy of the analysis to be able to determine which of the features of the acoustics or of the system can identify best when the individual is headed for an episode. So as is always, these research always brings up more questions rather than the answer. So we do know we're able to classify mood states using the acoustics. We are asking, you know, whether we can predict mood states in time to intervene. So it's not just that we can do this, is the important thing, is whether we can actually show that it works. And so one person was telling me, he says, listen, I was at a conference and there was a really obnoxious person there. And he said, listen, you know, if you can't show me that this is going to work with my patients, I'm not going to tell my patients to use it. So we need to work with the community now to engage folks in this with all due attention to security and to privacy to really, really test it. And are there other disorders that can be monitored? Well, we all know we sound somewhat different when we have the flu, right? I mean, you can hear it and you call up a friend and you say they just sound differently when they're ill. And so there's a pattern of behavior that changes when we're ill. So we're asking ourselves questions regarding the length of time necessary for clinical trials. So bipolar disorder, we think, is the ideal one to study because there are frequent mood swings in bipolar disorder. So the trial is going to exist or consist of individuals using priori and using the early warning sign, the check engine light, if you will. And we're going to have an intervention plan that we would put in place. And we'd compare that to a group that was, they would have the phone and they would we'll be collecting, you know, the acoustic analysis and that on that. But we wouldn't have a early warning system that would be used to sort of see, you know, this is how they did the polio trial. They exposed the individuals to the polio vaccine and then compared them to the individuals that weren't exposed to it. So we will do a similar sort of a thing here with priori. So this is a complex slide that is from the 1960s. And it's about lithium clinical trials. Very wonderful man, Mogens Schickskau from Denmark, had a brother with bipolar disorder. He was a psychiatrist, and he learned about lithium. And so he set about to study lithium in his patients. And so the straight line here is when the individual was put on lithium. These little solid large pieces here are when the individual was depressed. And these funny links here is when they had manic episodes. And so he just chronicled how people did over time and then put them on lithium. And you can see that when they got on lithium, the episodes diminished in frequency and they just did much better. And so this is the essence of how we justify or the clinical evidence for the use of lithium. So we need to do a similar sort of a thing. So we then will be looking at our endpoints, the number of episodes that the individual has, their mood instability, their functional outcomes. Does the priori actually help us prevent these episodes? We know that it works to be able to identify mood states. We know that it's feasible. We know that we can do it. It's just that when we go out to the larger population, we need to know that it is useful as an mHealth device, and we must absolutely demonstrate that it can work. So not only are we looking at the speech pattern, so when somebody talks into the phone, we're gathering that, but we can measure how many times the individual opens their phone, how much data usage that they have. We could, whether there's the accelerometers in place. So you can get a sense of what the individual is doing. How we interact with the world through our mobile device tells the individual a lot about their psychomotor energy, how their brain is functioning, what they're doing. And it's a good proxy way to interact or to measure the energy, intrinsic energy of the individual. So I'm going to just ask the individuals on the panel here just to introduce themselves, just with a sentence or two about what you do and your interests.
Sure. So my name is Jennifer Montgomery, and I am a clinical social worker. I work as a therapist, clinical social worker in the adult ambulatory clinic over at the Rachel Upjohn Building Depression Center, and I also work with the Heinze Prechter Bipolar Research Group as a clinical interviewer on numerous studies, including the Priori Project, and I have a study coordinator role with the Priori Project as well.
Thank you.
My name is John Gideon. I'm a PhD student at the University of Michigan in computer science. I work with Professor Emily Maurer Provost on emotion and mood research using machine learning techniques. And ever since the past summer, I've been on working with the Priori group on this project.
Hi, my name is Kelly Ryan. I'm a clinical neuropsychologist at the university, and I work with patients that have chronic illnesses, including different brain disorders and mental illness. And I study how those illnesses affect cognitive performance, and then also how cognitive performance impacts one's ability to function in their daily lives.
Thank you. And so I think I could just ask a question. How many individuals do we have already in the using Priori?
Question.
These are around 37 or 8.
Off the top of my head, because we just enrolled, I want to say, two or three new participants just this past week. So I think our grand total is somewhere upwards of 40.
Yeah. So we've had individuals that have been using the system for up to a year, which is I think actually quite phenomenal. Anybody here use a Fitbit or worn one of these wearable devices? Good. I see you don't have your Fitbit on you now. How long do? Oh, you have it there. Okay. The average person wearing a Fitbit will wear it for 3-4 months, and then it'll kind of be sitting on the wayside. Okay, very good question here. Have you considered looking at spending patterns or social media posting frequency or content to evaluate to evaluate mood states. And so I'll just pass it down.
So the spending patterns, we haven't started looking at yet, and it's not in our even next stages, I guess I should say, in terms of to-dos, only because we do have to be mindful of confidentiality to a certain degree and what participants would feel comfortable with us monitoring. But there absolutely could be some very telling information from having that data. And then the other one was social media postings and frequency.
Yeah.
And once again, I think that that would be really helpful information to have. And I think that that's even something we've talked about on our team, is having more information regarding social media usage. But right now, our application is not set up to be able to monitor that.
The most recent version of the app actually is able to record the amount of time that individuals use different apps on their phone.
Right. Yeah,
so we could potentially infer the amount of different postings that they're doing to Facebook, for example, by how often they have the Facebook app open. So mm-hmm. that could be one way that we could do that in a more passive way.
And that dovetails nicely into there's two questions here about the other ideas for, you know, to collect other phone data by use of Facebook. So that's there. But the other, this is for John, really. And can other cheaper activity sensors detect different states, depressed versus manic and bipolar disorder? So activity sensors, what other activity sensors could we think about?
I guess that would be like a Fitbit or possibly I'm trying to think what other sensors there would be, pedometer.
We had that, there was one where the researchers from MIT that were visiting with us a week or so ago. They had a thing on there that measured actually kind of galvanic skin response and that heart rate, sort of physiological measures. I wonder, with that, do you think we could think about how we could integrate that?
We could potentially integrate it into a program where individuals wore that type of watch, and then also we gather the same data that we are currently from their cell phones.
And they have those sensors now on the new phones that measure heart rate and blood oxygenation level. Okay. So working something like that into a study, I think, is pretty feasible.
Yeah. The question also has come up about, whether the devices that are in existence out there, we're fussing with the, or are experimenting with the watches, that Samsung has made to measure, count steps, and that. And so there are a number of options. There are a number of things that are out there, but again, because there's so many things that one could try, that it's we have to really focus on which are the best. I think that Kelly, in terms of what people will actually want to do, what is your perspective on, and how do we motivate people to use these?
I think probably providing some information that's going to be helpful back to the patient themselves. So what they're doing, what they're monitoring, is going to tell them something about themselves that might give them the early warning signal to contact their provider. So knowing that they're going to get something out of it and that it's going to benefit either their care or their personal well-being in some way.
A very important question here is, how do you measure a person's baseline? So I'm going to just start on my left here with Jennifer and just go down the row here.
That's a really good question. And I think that it can be really challenging. What is really helpful, at least from the perspective of the priori study, is that all of the participants who are engaged in this study are also engaged in our longitudinal project. And as a part of our longitudinal study, we do what's called a Diggs interview. And this is a very in-depth interview that sometimes can take up to 4 hours to get through, if not longer than that. So we do have a lot of information on the participants that are engaged in this project, and so we're really able to look back on what their mood has been like over their lifetime up until the point where they enroll in participating in any of the projects with the Proctor Fund. So sometimes having that additional information can be really helpful with really determining what a patient's baseline looks like. So are they able to identify any mood states in the course of their life that haven't involved either hypomania, mania, or depression? And sometimes that can be challenging for some of the participants. So there isn't one answer for that, but I think that at least from the perspective of the participation in this study, it's really having all of that information over time to be able to really say what that person in particular identifies as being the norm for them.
Particularly to the priori study, what I use in the machine learning side as the baseline is individuals that are involved in the study every week engage in this assessment with a clinician at the Depression Center. And when they perform this assessment, they are gauged on the two scales of how intense their their depression or their mania has been over the past week. So I can use that as a gauge of their baseline of when it's at the lower rating scale.
And I'm going to echo what Jennifer said, that using some of the longitudinal data that we get from the longitudinal study is very helpful in identifying what the patient is telling us is their baseline. So sometimes baseline for one individual might be just a mild level of depression, where for another person it might be complete euthymia, so no symptoms of depression and mania. And I think we can see that in our data that we capture every couple months. And I think that helps us identify a baseline.
Well, and just to add one more thing, it not only helps us identify a baseline, but it helps the participants identify what their baseline is, because the participants who've been engaged in longitudinal for a while now, maybe even a couple of years, they're used to us asking these same questions over and over again with their interviews. And so they actually start to really identify more with what their baseline is based on the questions that we've asked them over time. So when they join Priori and we're asking similar questions that we've been asking with longitudinal, they're able to identify with that, and that's been really helpful.
And I would also add that from a cognitive perspective, we don't have a good way of identifying what one's baseline cognitive performance is like before illness, because most of the time we see patients after they have been diagnosed with some type of mental illness. But we do have some cognitive tests that provide us estimates of how someone was probably functioning before they became sick with an illness. And that illness may be bipolar disorder or depression or some other neurological condition.
And I think that it's also, the pattern of usage, of either the phone or of whatever we're doing, it actually kind of helps establish a baseline. And some of us, looking at our electrical or our utility bill, they'll send you a little thing. This is how you compare. This is what your baseline. Last month you did this and last month you did that. Credit card companies, they will give you a call if something comes out of the ordinary, that all of a sudden you're in a car shop and you're about to buy a car on your credit card. They're very likely to give you a call because this is out of your baseline. Whereas you're going to Kroger's and buying groceries for a very familiar amount of money, they won't flag that as being a problem. But that, in a sort of very sort of magnified way, is what Priori is doing. And then on the base of our basic assessment, there's a very important question here. A number of very important questions. All of them really just incredible. But one of them is the context of the legal protection and security measures in place for the system. And so Many of you will know about the Institutional Review Board, which is the ethical review systems that any academic or any research institution must adhere to. And I think, Jennifer, you've dealt a lot with the IRB, and if you wanted to comment on, you know, what we do for what the IRB is and how we've addressed that.
Yeah, so the IRB is the review board that essentially looks over all of the research that we do and makes sure that it is safe for participants to be engaging in, and it really it looks at the level of risk that's involved in doing the study, if there is risk, and really holds us to making sure that we do whatever is within our power to minimize risk. So there has been a lot of security measures put in place to protect participants' confidentiality and safety as they engage in this study. One of the measures that we have put in place is called a certificate of confidentiality. And what that means is that even under legal subpoena, we do not have to release any information regarding participants' involvement in the study. The only time in which we may have to break any type of confidentiality would be if, as a clinician, me working with the participants week by week, if I thought that that participant was either a harm to themselves or could potentially be a harm to others. I always have a legal obligation as a mental health provider to report that. But that would be the only instance in which by law we would release any type of information.
And thank you. And I think that I would like just John to address some of computational and computer science engineering issues around the security of it.
So from the moment that the individual that's using the phone begins a conversation, the call is immediately encrypted as it's being recorded. So at no moment is the call on the phone in an unencrypted form. So if somebody was ever to steal an individual's phone, those calls would be completely unplayed. It would not be able to be played back on that phone. In addition, when it's uploaded to our servers, we use encryption to ensure that if it's intercepted along the way, that no one would be able to acquire the data. And then once we do analysis and do feature extraction, we only use methods that look into different acoustics of the audio that have been shown to not be identifiable. So they only contain information such as fluctuations in pitch or energy over time, rather than the actual content of the conversation itself. So that once we go and take those features for analysis, those features would not be able to be reversed back to the original conversation.
Thank you. And I just want to, you know, the other interesting thing that I was told is that so each of the telephone calls is encrypted in its own way. So if someone were to spend a good amount of time figuring out how to decrypt one conversation, it's a dynamic key so that each individual call is encrypted in its own way. And so that, I can't explain it in a more complicated manner than that. But it's relatively profound. So Kelly, wanted to pass one along here regarding the self-selection of the participants and how the app distinguishes between an isolated occurrence. So let me read a couple of questions here for you, because I think that I wanted to you to start off this discussion. To what degree does self-selection by the participant influence the response or lack of responses when using Priori? How does the app distinguish between an isolated occurrence, such as an angry call with Comcast, I noted that, and a manic depressive episode? At what point are the patients alerted that they need to see their physician? And then there was another one about sort of the check engine light. Who does it alert? So I'll let you start off this discussion.
I think with most of the research that we do, individuals that self-select themselves to participate in research tend to be very motivated to participate in whatever project we have going on. So if someone's identifying wanting to be part of Priori, I think the basic assumption is that they want to know a little bit more about themselves and they want to contribute to research. And I think those participants may be very different than participants who have no interest in research at all. But hopefully, I think by doing the Priori, we can prove that it's effective and it can work. And then that could be applied to patients, whether they're participants in a research study or not. So it can kind of cross over to more of a general population.
And then, so thank you. The distinguishing between an isolated occurrence, the conversation with Comcast, versus the ongoing system. John, do you want to kind of start on that one?
So to be clear, at this point, we have not started to do any form of intervention to the individuals. Right. We're just making sure that we get the system to be accurate enough before we start doing any form of intervention. But as far as looking at differences between short-term angry calls, for example, interpreting that as mood. One possibility that we can look into for that is that mood usually fluctuates over longer periods of time. So rather than looking at an individual phone call, the analysis would look into all these different sensors that we're looking at. So if one individual phone call shows possibly that there could be some change in mood here, but all the other sensors say otherwise. The machine learning technique would be able to try to filter out some of these possible short-term things that do not necessarily have to do with the underlying mood. But it is definitely an open question that we still need to look into with other things that potentially interfere with the way, especially that audio works. One that's been brought up often is how drinking alcohol affects people's voices. So there's definitely a lot of things that need to be looked into to try to isolate different things besides mood that affect audio. But definitely looking into that.
I think that one of the things that that John and others came up with in our most recent emendation of the protocol was how do we in fact determine if it's if it's calling Comcast or ordering a pizza in that. And so the question that we would have is are there certain numbers that the individual contacts or has a conversation with that wherein more emotions are expressed, and so we'd be able to deal or to use those conversations. And I think, Jennifer, that you have that experience with people when you're asking them how they're doing, that their emotions kind of are more evident, if you will, on an assessment call. Mm-hmm. And how is your mood? And people will talk about it and they'll put their emotion into the mood. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. Sometimes when I do the assessments, participants will report to me that they weren't doing well over the course of the previous week, but in that moment when they're on the phone with me, they're stating that they're doing much better. So it can vary depending on how things are going for the participant in that moment. However, just to kind of follow up with what John was saying, the assessments are also helpful that we do, the weekly assessments, because participants can, report to me these events with, like, Comcast or the confrontation that they got into with their teenager. They can give me more of those details. So I can, make notes of that and kind of track maybe more of these social or environmental stressors that are occurring over the week to piece apart how mood-related that is compared to just socially and environmentally triggered, per se.
So there's a very important question here, and it says, does the check engine light alert the patient, the provider, or both? And I think it's important to just to appreciate that the stage of the research is in the validation of the process, is that can we identify features of speech that associate with mood the next step is to identify how we can implement an intervention. So we're, the steps along a research project is that it is identified. It takes often up to 5 years for a project to really see the light of day and have some reassuring data that it works, and then we move on to the next phase to go and actually test it. So we're right on the cusp of testing whether the check engine light is going to work properly. So I just wanted to make sure we emphasized that. So if you're interested in signing up for a pilot, a priori, how would you do that? Are you collaborating with another university? Is the Priori app available for a person, diagnosed with bipolar and lives near Ann Arbor? So, Jennifer, you're kind of involved in the engaging of folks. Let's pass it down to you, and then.
Yeah. So right now we're really recruiting most of our participants out of our longitudinal project, which is what I had kind of referred to earlier. However, we're always looking for more participants to be engaged in longitudinal in addition to Priori. So if that's something that anyone was interested in, we could definitely provide more information about that. And at some point in time in the future, we will be recruiting participants for the project outside of the longitudinal study due to the number of participants that, as the project continues to grow, we would hope to be able to recruit. So right now, we are not recruiting participants that are outside of longitudinal, but in the future, it's very likely that that will be happening.
And when you say longitudinal, that's the Prechter bipolar, the base study at the University of
Prechter bipolar longitudinal study.
And the reason that we're using those individuals is?
The reason for why we're using those individuals in particular is because of how much information we already have on those participants, and we are able to quickly identify the fact that they meet criteria for bipolar 1, bipolar 2, and rapid cycling. We are trying to focus on recruiting participants that meet criteria for rapid cycling, so have at least 4 mood episodes in a single year in order to maximize the possible data that we would be able to collect during their participation. Right now, participants have the option of participating in the study for up to a year, so being able to identify participants that might actually experience a mood episode would be helpful.
Yeah.
As far as the availability of the app currently is concerned, we do not have it publicly anywhere. It's being controlled through the study at the moment. Actually, every phone that we give out to individuals has to be loaded, particularly by me to load it up. But we're working actively towards developing an app that would be able to be more actively distributed so that we'd be able to have it able to be engaging more people.
Yeah. And it's also important, that individuals that are participating in the longitudinal study that live outside of Ann Arbor. And so the individual that we're interested in recruiting to help test this, it's an individual with bipolar disorder that has a number of had a history sometime in their in the course of their illness of a number of episodes over the course of time. And as you saw the one slide with all the high amplitude experiences that there are a number of individuals that have rapid cycling bipolar disorder. So Kelly, back down to you. Are you using other mobile tools such as daily monitoring to monitoring scales, rating scales for people to fill out? For example, Mood 27, or thought about other self-report assessment tools such as measuring circadian rhythms? So other devices. I know you're actually doing a lot of other things as well.
Yeah, we have a new pilot project that's in its development stage, and hopefully we're going to start recruiting and collecting data for. It's a study where we're using smartphones and creating an app that asks information about how one is doing in their daily functioning. So it asks questions, how are you performing at work or school? How are your interactions with friends and family? Having participants actually rate their mood a couple times a day and complete some cognitive tests. So there's a survey piece that they're doing twice a day. And then we're also collecting a bunch of this sensor information on the phone, like number of phone calls and text messages sent, GPS data. We're going to have participants wear an activity tracker to capture physical activity and sleep. And the idea is, can any of these sensor data on the phone be proxy measurements for the mood data we're collecting or the cognitive data? And can we predict some of these fluctuations in mood based on one's typical cell phone use or based on someone's fluctuation in their cognitive performance based on the tests that they're performing? Or can we use information that we collect on how one is rating their mood or using their phone to help predict how well someone's functioning in their daily life?
Yeah, with the emphasis of helping predict on that, I saw, John, that I was going to ask you about the one system of the touching, the photo, the image of how you're feeling now.
Yeah, the PAM system.
Yeah, and talk about that. That's really cool.
So one system that we're looking into potentially using as a self-reporting method in a future version of the app would be something called the PAM. The way it works is the participant is given a 4x4 grid of images, and essentially they select the one image that best correlates with the emotion that they're currently feeling or the mood that they're currently in. And that could be one way that would be a bit more intuitive to rate on, rather than trying to use this hard scale of like a 1 to 10 type thing. So we've been looking at potential new ways to do self-assessments.
So I don't know if anyone here has used the Mood 24/7. I tried it for like 3 months one time, and it becomes intrusive. And so anytime you have to do something, I found it annoying. And so there was a paper that came out from friends of mine in the UK a number of years ago, and they were looking at what were the features of mHealth apps that were attractive to people, to the end users. So it has to be minimally intrusive, very unobvious, in other words, so incorporate it as much into your daily routine as you possibly can, and just not obvious that you're using it. And so people putting on a device, and as you ask, so what do you got there? You got your Fitbit on and so you notice that as a part of someone's daily routine. So people want to have things that they don't have to do anything on. And so the mobile device, the mobile phone, is something that we by and large have with us all the time now. If I am off to work and I realize I've forgotten my phone, I will turn around and go home and get it. It's a part of me as my shoes, essentially. You know, and so you don't leave home without wearing your shoes. So this is why the mobile device, if we can just capture how we interact with the mobile device, why I think it is very, very successful. So there's a question if you're interested in signing up. We do have information booklets at the back as to how to sign up for the study. Please be in touch, and we will be delighted to talk to you more about that. Question about collaborating with other universities. I think, John, you were involved in the collaboration with Brown. Were you involved in those discussions? There's a suicide research group at Brown University on the East Coast. And so they are interested, and we submitted a grant together to examine whether there are features in the speech of an individual that identifies a suicide risk.
So there's definitely many potential collaborations that could be facilitated by this app that we've been looking into.
Kelly, do you want to speak about the University of Chicago?
Yes. So the University of Chicago have similar individuals to John, where they have expertise in computer science, and they're developing some ways to capture typing speed on the smartphone and using the typing speed or the types of errors that you make, including backspaces, as proxy measurements of cognitive functioning and impulsivity and how that might be related to mood. And we're hoping to collaborate and use their developed app in our next smartphone study, where we're collecting some of the cognitive data. And so we'll have cognitive data measuring impulsivity and cognitive control. And then we have this app where we think might be a proxy measurement for those same skills. So we're hoping to collaborate and collect data at both sites on the smartphone.
And I think it's also important that we just, you know, point out that we're in discussions with Blue Cross Network about about their interest in engaging in using this. We're discussing with the clinics around the University of Michigan and elsewhere in the state to engage individuals with this. And I was just in a conversation, very interesting conversation this morning, with cancer center individuals to use it for, you know, in that arena. Thinking about incorporating a self-report mood assessment rating, such as in the circadian rhythms, and so that really we've kind of addressed with the PAM there. But there are a number of questions that are focusing on whether. What would the intervention look like? And so, Kelly, you want to start out the answer and work our way in?
I think one important piece of an intervention is identifying what that early warning signal is and having some kind of bidirectional relationship with the patient's clinical provider, saying, alert, this individual is having a hard time or is about to have a hard time, and then the provider can step in and follow them up clinically. I think at a very basic level, just using this as some kind of measurement tool to notify providers or to provide some kind of log that the provider or the patient can review at upcoming appointments. I think that information can be an intervention in itself.
So the idea of considering it as a check engine light type, where it either alerts you to immediately go see your doctor, or potentially has a log of things when you go to the doctor. But
Right.
I was also just going to add to that by saying it could also be a really helpful way of even notifying family or friends or just anyone that's in that individual's support network to maybe indicate that, you know, I need a little bit more help right now, or something's changing. You know, it might just give, you know, mom or dad or whoever the support network is in that person's life the heads up that, you know, it might be a good time to call and just see how things are going.
Thank you. So there's a couple of questions here that I think are that really kind of strike to in the heart of the matter. And it talks about a couple of features and the emerging of the what symptoms emerge earliest. What is the order of the symptom emergence? And is there a point at which the individual is made aware, or are they just given specific scores or just an early warning sign? Is there any way to quantify how much and how well priority works? And a corollary to that, if the participant is comfortable in the hypomania state, what is their motivation to have an intervention? Well, one of my wonderful patients told me that hypomania is such that if you could bottle that and sell it, you would be richer than you could ever imagine, because the hypomanic state is singularly one of the most, in its sort of euphoric, mildly euphoric states, it's singularly one of the most desirable states of humanity, is my sense. And the individuals describe this state where they're funny, they're comfortable, they're confident, they're fast, they say good jokes, people like them, they go out and about, and it's just they feel good about themselves and people like them.
What's there not to like about that? Why do you want to change this? And so we have a number of people, that are visible in the media that seem to function quite well in that phase. And I've had people tell me time and time again, yeah, it's a great state, but the problematic thing is that when you go further and further up the mountain, there's less and less oxygen. And that I get into trouble, faster than you can shake a stick when I'm way up there, and that's when bad things happen. But if I could just stay, in the foothills there in that good place, that would be ideal. So it's the individual that goes and the trajectory on it. So what is your perception, your view of what things are emerging first or what are?
I think with a hypomanic or a manic episode, a lot of patients or participants do report changes in their speech, which is really what, gave us the idea behind this project, is that family members notice the changes in the speech, and those are the early warning signs that something might be occurring. I've had some patients tell me that they can notice just from the way they sign their name that there's just a subtle difference in their handwriting, even. I think another really common symptom is decreased need for sleep. And, noticing that the amount of sleep that they need is starting to get shorter and shorter, but the energy is still there. So those are just a few of the common symptoms that patients report and that, as a clinician, I've seen people present with.
Objectively, from the AI machine learning side of it, I haven't yet looked into the idea of how the onset of different symptoms changes as an episode becomes closer. But I have looked into somewhat the symptomology of things that can be picked up in the voice as you approach. And a few that I've seen are different changes in the way that the individual uses pitch in a conversation, or the back and forth that occurs during a conversation. One thing for mania that's known is pressure of speech. So the pattern of how a back and forth in the conversation will change possibly under the different mood states. And along with that, different variations in the rhythms of the conversation. So for example, an individual in a depressed or a manic mood state might have less variations over the course of a phone call, as they'll be more in the quickened speech or the slowed speech of the mood.
And more from clinical experience, adding to what Jennifer was saying about sleep, I think some of the early changes could be increased in activity, so doing multitasking, doing many things at once and jumping from task to task, or being kind of impulsive in your thinking or in your behavior. And I think with some of the other studies that we have coming, can we capture some of that on the phone? Someone who is starting to reach the early stages of a hypomania, are they, rapidly flipping through all their apps and constantly checking their Facebook or making lots of phone calls and texting? Are those subtle or maybe not so subtle changes in behavior really predicting the onset of a more problematic shift in mood?
So with regards to the specific score, I'm interested in John's point on this, but I think that from my perspective, I think we're going to be working around a probability. And so if you get a certain set of results and you'd say there is a 80% chance that that things are going to be unstable in the next week or two, and that. So, John, you want to speak to the statistics around what kind of a score, how we quantify the change?
So ultimately, with machine learning, on the output, you're going to get some sort of probability of how certain you are of the diagnosis of an upcoming depressed or manic mood state. So the idea with it is that would be coming when looking at the intervention side of the study would be what amount of probability of an upcoming episode would we want to intervene.
Right. And so that, you know, and so we hope with the using the analogy of the credit card companies, if they see, you know, something kind of spikes or there's all of a sudden a change in the spending patterns and that you're spending more in the mall at a particular, you know, over time, you know, that they'll say there's something, there's a pattern that's changing. And so then you would hit, you know, all of a sudden, you know, there's something that's coming up. And so the machine learning itself, you know, as that changes, they would give a higher likelihood that there is a true change going on. And so there's very interesting mathematics behind this. And so we're delighted to have formed a seminar on computational psychiatry, wherein we have mathematicians, we have physicists, we have biostatisticians, we have computational computer science folks, and psychiatrists all together around a table thinking about the patterns of illness in bipolar disorder. And so we've had our second seminar on this, and so we've thought this is quite unique, and I think only at the University of Michigan can we do this. Further questions. Questions like a halter event. Could you use it like a halter event monitor, such as used in cardiology, where the patient can identify co-occurring scenarios? So, Kelly, do you think this is going to be a halter kind of a device?
I think it could be. I mean, we carry our cell phones around all the time. It's constantly on, even when we're in events where we have to silence it. It's still on. So it may capture something. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is a question, how can you get someone help who doesn't recognize that they have a problem, and how would you intervene? So there's a theme that is coming in terms of intervening here. And so, Jennifer, in terms of how do you get someone help who doesn't recognize?
Well, I think that, you know, trying to have a conversation with this individual that you're concerned about is a place to start. Being as open and honest as possible about specifically what you're seeing that is concerning to you, and trying to come from a supportive, empathetic, caring place as much as possible so that that person can hear you and hear your concerns would be an important place to start. And, you know, maybe even trying to partner with this person in terms of, you know, being willing to go to appointments with them or help them find the resources and really trying to be a support, and it being something that maybe you do together, instead of having this person do it on their own. But, you know, if a person really truly doesn't want any type of psychiatric services, there is only so much you can do. Of course, if you feel as though someone is a harm to themselves or a harm to others, you can always call the authorities and request that a wellness check be performed. And in those cases, a police officer will go to the person's home, we'll check in with them, see how they're doing, and at that point in time, we'll be able to make a decision on whether or not they think that that person needs to be transferred to a hospital for psychiatric evaluation. And after the individual is transferred to the hospital, then the medical team there would have to make the decisions in terms of how to proceed from that point. Of course, that's a more severe, you know, way to go, but sometimes that is necessary. And if you really feel like it's reached that point, then that's sometimes what needs to be done, and it's within that person's best interest.
So one of the things that, number of the themes that are, do you want to have a comment or any other?
I think
somebody leads right. One of the comments that is coming up is how can we envision the identification of who to identify the problem to? And so we were presenting this to, the reason I love working with engineers is that they're very rational and organized, and John helps us tremendously. John and his colleagues, they help us with that. And so one of them said to me, so well, you know, if the family can hear it in the voice, why don't we just tell the family member this, and then the family member can say to the person, please, you need to go see your doctor because you're sounding funny right now or sounding different, and so there's a sound in your voice that indicates that you're either becoming manic or depressed. And I don't know, I've had one or two patients over the years that have come and tell me that, you know, Dr. McGinnis, I'm just here because, my wife just said to me, said, George, you got to go see your doctor. Something going on, with you now. It's just really important that you go see. You say, I don't know what it is. And he says, my wife is so wonderful, and he was very happy that she would identify, you know, this. But for the most part, it's been my experience that this kind of identification of a problem results in, what do you mean? I'm okay. You're the one that's got the problem, you know, or something like that. And so it ends in a confrontation rather than a support. So we are actually open to a lot of suggestions from the audience and from folks here as to what would be the best way to identify this. And we're emphasizing the following point, is that this is really, you know, the first project in of this nature that is going on essentially in the country. There are a few other individuals, and we've, you know, talked with them and interact with them, that are doing similar thing, but nobody is doing the exact same thing that we are doing. So we've struggled with this question, and so we can sort of kind of share our ideas of what we thought about. But it's a very important question, is that what happens, you know, when the check engine light that John is designing goes off? What do we do? Kelly, you want to start the discussion on that?
I think, first of all, not everyone has supportive relationships with other people that may be around or know them well enough to identify changes in speech. So that could be one major limitation that I think that the study can probably capture.
Mm-hmm. So one of the thoughts that I've had is that, you know, you have the big board, in a clinic. And so that I could envision, for example, a nurse or a social worker, you know, they're manning the big board, and there could be a check engine light there that comes on, and all of a sudden something pops on, and you've got, you know, Mr. Jones in Lansing or wherever that's giving us a signal that there's something changing in his pattern. So we've thought about that, and then we could call them,
yeah.
Call their doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as a clinician working in the adult ambulatory department, I would love to receive like an email or a page or some type of notification if there's a possibility one of my patients are in some type of distress. So any way of, you know, having this check engine light allow me as a clinician to act or, you know, address any possible concerns sooner rather than later would be, I think, ideal.
And there's a very interesting question regarding the vocal monitoring. It says a bipolar patient who has learned to cover up his depression and speak in a normal tone of voice. And so any parent here who has a child in college can know, you know, you ask, you know, hi, Sally, how's it going? So, oh, everything's fine, Mom, everything's fine. You know something's wrong, right? I mean, so people try to cover up their emotions all the time. And I think that it has been an interesting experience with the revved up speech for the depressed speech. Have they been able to cover one better than the other, do you think? Because my impression that we were able, that individuals were able to conceal more of their depression, because an individual that's depressed often knows they're depressed, whereas when they're revved up, they have a lesser amount of insight.
I think that the insight is a huge part of it. The more elevated or revved up that someone becomes, typically the insight decreases. That's not for all individuals who experience hypomania or mania. But, you know, I guess the other question is to what degree is someone who's experiencing hypomania, mania, or depression really covering it up? Or are people still able to kind of tell that something's wrong and might just not be saying anything or addressing it?
One investigation that we're potentially planning on doing with this new information about unique phone calls. So we're gathering the ability so that we could see the acoustics of the calls to an individual person. So for example, somebody's mother versus somebody's boss. So something that you could look into potentially for that is when somebody's in a depressed mood state versus a manic mood state. Would their acoustics vary greatly of their symptoms between speaking with their mother versus an employer? And how much is an individual actually able to cover up certain symptoms?
And I also imagine pairing the acoustic data with other forms of data might improve our accuracy in identifying the mood state. So maybe for some individuals, acoustics may give us a yellow light, but if you pair that with some other cell phone behaviors, that might lead you to the full blinking, flashing red light that there's something going on.
For example, there are a few questions here that are focusing on speech. Does the app monitor at night? And there are other sleep measures that are available on these mobile devices. Priority really doesn't work at night. It only works when you're talking on the phone, essentially.
You can infer to some extent night, not from the audio, but you could potentially look at patterns of sleep or activity of using the phone based on when it's receiving data or not. So it wouldn't be able to gather information on acoustics, whatever that would mean, while an individual is sleeping. But it could potentially still infer things like sleep patterns.
So there was another interesting question about the outliers of life-changing events or life events, you know, kind of a thing. So that, you know, we all know that, you know, if somebody calls up and you've won the lottery, that you're going to sound slightly different, you know, comparatively to your regular tone of voice. Or if you hear news of a tragic event and, you know, our voice changes, or if you get mad, and the example of Comcast was pointed out here. So that, how are we going, and then related to various different things like drinking, gambling, and that. So how are we going to address that?
I think
not everyone at once.
It's again this idea of trying to capture those different moments, seeing if we can filter for the longer term mood versus shorter term variations, and being able to potentially adapt to new norms if somebody's patterns change.
So the example would be that if somebody goes to Detroit and to the MGM Grand on Fridays and is there, you know, and then you know that the activity or the voice is going to change on that, or if somebody does Monday Night Football at the local watering hole, or if they, you know, if on Sunday, you know, they end up talking to someone on the phone, or there's a particular pattern. So the machine would learn, you know, how this works. And so it's much like, you know, your credit score or your credit, you know, and you know that you go shopping for groceries on you know, Saturday morning. And so you know that you're going to get a spike in your spending pattern there. So I think the idea would be that that we would pick potentially, the emphasis is on potentially pick that up. So I think that those patterns are all there. So I see that Jenny is standing there. We've got 3 minutes, but I wanted to firstly thank everyone for coming out, and I want to again thank you for all the wonderful questions that you have. We're packaging them up here. The reason that we are doing this is based on our dedication to trying to identify ways to help our patients and the people that we work with in a better manner. One of the things that people tell me all the time is that, you know, I just didn't see this coming. It happened. It just came out of the blue. And I talked to a family member and says, well, you know, I heard it. There was something about that. There was something different that I kind of picked up on. You know, I just couldn't quite put my finger on it, but they just sort of sounded different, you know, and there was nothing really that they did. So the challenges that we have at the level of the health systems in here and around the country is that we've got these ridiculous wait lists. And we have waiting times to get in to see the doctors. We have wait times for everything. We need to develop a system, an on-demand system in medicine, so that we can monitor people. And when a signal comes to the big board, if you will, and wherever the big board is, it could be a family member, it could be a friend, or anyone that the individual designates and says, will you help me monitor my illness? So once that check engine light comes on, and we can prioritize that individual for management, for care, for an intervention. So you think about Michigan, there's 10 million people in the state of Michigan. Bipolar 1 disorder, the more severe form, is 1% of the illness. That means that there are 100,000 individuals in the state of Michigan with bipolar disorder. And the question I have, and I ask myself every day, how many people out there with bipolar disorder are in danger of suicide, in danger of losing their family, of losing everything that they have because of an episode? And how can we develop a way to protect those individuals and get them into care in a timely manner? And I truly think that Priori will be able to, or systems like it, or technology, is going to help us prioritize these individuals for care. And so that's what drives us in this. So keep an eye on us. Follow us on the website. Keep us posted as to what your ideas are. We have a Facebook account, and we welcome all kinds of ideas and things that you would want to let us know. So we have all kinds of ways to interact and hear from you. So with that, I thank the panel members for your contributions, and I thank everyone for coming out tonight, and Jenny and the library system here for hosting us now tonight and over the years. So thank you all.